Hi, everyone. Larry, are you prepared to lead the opening prayer?
Of course.
Thank you.
Oh, Heavenly Father,
Oh, Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Divine Mother,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Blessed Master,
Blessed Master,
Dearest Mother,
Dearest Mother,
Beloved David,
Beloved David,
Saints and Sages of all religions,
saints and sages of all religions,
I bow to all of you.
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles
Free my life from all obstacles
and give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
and give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only king.
Be thou the only king,
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Peace.
Peace,
Bliss.
bliss.
Amen.
Amen. Today we have chapter 17 from In Quest of God. I'll start with Papa right away. Taraknath Temple. The Bengali sadhu was standing simply staring at the spectacle. At last, coming to himself, he suggested they might go out of the room, as other spots had also to be visited. Most reluctantly, Ram Dass got up and came out of that heavenly place. Next, the sadhu guided him, and he was in a state of a complete dreaminess at the time, to a garden behind the room, and pointed to a cluster of five trees called Panjavati, around which a circular platform of earth and stones was raised. Here the Paramahansa used to sit frequently and offer Upadesh to his disciples, explained the sadhu. Then he led the way to a small hut wherein he said the saint used to sit in samadhi, or deep meditation of his favorite ideal, Mother Kali. O Ram Dass, thy eyes are indeed blessed by these sights. Flow on tears, warm with the glow of supreme happiness. Now the Bengali sadhu proposed to take him on a visit to a young sannyasi, a disciple of Sri Ramakrishna. Agreeing, he was escorted and led away from the temple site for about a mile, where two sannyasis were found busy worshipping in front of the picture of Paramahansa and Kali, placed in a small mandir. Ram Dass and the sadhu, on prostrating before the sannyasis, were invited to sit inside the temple. The puja over, they were given some prasad. On partaking of it, they sought permission to depart. Coming back to the Kali temple, the Bengali sannyasi led the two sadhus to the banks of the Ganges, where the steamboat jetty was situated. From this place, the sannyasi pointed out the place called Belur Math, on the other side of the Ganges. He procured tickets for Ram Dass and the Sadhu Ram and conducted them to the steamboat, which they duly boarded. But before leaving, he suggested that when traveling onwards by train, they might make a halt at a shrine called Taraknath or Taraknatheshwar, a place worth visiting. This suggestion was kept in mind, since it came from Ram himself, whose kindness was felt at every step of this most marvelous and memorable pilgrimage. In due course, both the sadhus landed on the opposite side of the Ganges. A walk of about 2 furlongs brought them to a small temple, where there resided a number of young men belonging to different parts of India. One of them took the sadhus inside the temple, in which a painting of the Paramahansa was placed for daily worship. On inquiry, it was found that the temple was erected over the ashes of Sri Ramakrishna. Then the sadhus visited the beautiful samadhis raised over the remains of Swami Vivekananda and the Holy Mother, the wife of Sri Ramakrishna. Ram Dass, wishing to spend a night at the math, expressed his desire to the friends of the place, but was told that as there was no accommodations, it was not possible to accede to his request. It was all the wish of Ram, who does everything for good. Thence they proceeded to the nearest railway station and got into a train going west. And one morning they found themselves at the Tarakeshwar station, where they alighted. They proceeded straight to a famous temple of Tarakanath, in which it is said a Shiva Linga had its spontaneous birth, breaking up the roots of a Palmara tree, hence the name Tarakanath. After bath and darshan, the sadhus went out to the city. Making inquiries, they learnt that some liberal Raj was feeding 40 to 50 sadhus every day with a sumptuous dinner. Coming to the place, they waited, along with many others, outside the Dharmashala. About 11 o'clock, an old friend, the manager of the Kestra, called in the sadhus, counting the number required, and let them in, one by one. On a long veranda in two rows, facing each other, all the sadhus sat down, and leafy plates were placed before them. When the food was being served, a new sadhu of middle age came in and demanded food. The manager of the Kestra at first refused to take him, as the number to be fed was complete. But at the mention of the fact that the sadhu that he had not had any meals for 2 days past, he was offered a leaf and he sat down at the place, which happened to be just opposite Ram Dass. The dinner consisted of wheat puris, pretty thick and about 16 inches in diameter, some bhaji or curry, and sweets. At first, each was served with two puris and sweets, etc., the puris having been prepared out of mill-made mixed wheat flour, flexible like rubber. Ram Dass was wanting in teeth. In all, he had not had not half a dozen teeth in his mouth. Even those who had the full complement had to struggle hard with the puris before they could be thrust down the throat. Ram Dass' case was hence unique. Now the sadhu, the latest arrival for the dinner, sitting in front, was observed to have finished his share in less than 2 minutes. He was served again with four puris, which also disappeared in a thrice, again four more, and they met with the same fate. The sadhu was looking for more. At this juncture, the old friend ordered the cook to fetch out the whole stock of puris from the kitchen. Then he approached the sadhu and said, "Maharaj, you may take as many as you like." And he served 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on until he counted 20. Still the sadhu would not stop. Four more, and then the friend stopped, assuring the sadhu that he shall have some more after finishing those already served. At this stage, the attention of all the sadhus was directed toward the voracious eater. All commenced to watch his eating process. But for him, the sadhu was calm and determined. Puri after puri disappeared. It mattered not for him what was going on around him. At every four or five puris, he was drinking water out of a big brass pot he had by his side. Most of the sadhus present there could not eat more than four each. The record with some did not exceed six, but the phenomenal sadhu had been served in all 34 puris. He had also served more bhaji or curry and sweets. He ate them all with one pot full of water in the bargain. The affair is narrated here not out of any disrespect to the sadhu, but to apprise the reader of the case of a man who had a tremendous appetite, showing forth the wonderful Maya of Ram. After 2 days' stay at the shrine, Ram Das and the Sadhu Ram left the station and came to Gaya, where they obtained darshan in the temple and had a bath in the holy river. The next day they started and reached the famous shrine of the north, Kashi, also known as Benares. The Swamiji's thoughts on this one, which is kind of a unique chapter. Many times we may be drawn into situations where someone may be mocked at because of certain behavioral patterns. However, we should try to empathize with the person and not join in the mockery. When we are tested, our love, which is expressed through the service, should remain unconditional. Never take anything lightly. Never look down upon any incident. There is a lesson to be learned from every situation. I think about Papa struggling to even eat one because they were so rubbery, and for this man to come in after not eating for 2 days and to just, it sounds like with relish, eat as many as his stomach would hold, and to be allowed to do that. And that there's room in God's kingdom for both extremes. And that we listen to what we're directed to do in each moment. Whether the sadhu was listening to God's words, God's direction, certainly there's something there for Papa to devote one of the longest chapters in the book to it. It's quite interesting. And as Papa tells it, it's amusing and uplifting at the same time to just see the variety that God creates and to be open to the joy that can come from observing God's creations in action. And the fact that they bent the rules to let that sadhu in, certainly there was something special about him. Because many times sadhus will say they haven't eaten for days and still be turned away. So for Papa to write about him and for him to be allowed, there's some blessing, some peace to come from that. It's very amusing to think of him. One after another. Four, then six, then as many as he could eat.
Prophet describes it.
Yeah. And for the cooks and the folks working there, it might have been a delightful thing that they might so often receive condemnation if their puris are tough and rubbery and this person just relished them. So chapter 18, Kashi. The city of Kashi is a city of magnificent temples, the domes and turrets of which, when viewed from a height, lend a charm to the scene on the banks of the holy river Ganges. The whole of India rightly recognizes that Kashi is one of the most important shrines of Hindustan. Every day, pilgrims by thousands are pouring into the place from all parts of India. As Ram took Ram Das on this pilgrimage in winter, the cold was very great here, and the Sadhu Ram and he had not sufficient clothing, and sleeping as they were in an open place, on the bank of the river, the cold was very acutely, especially by the Sadhu Ram, felt. The Sadhu Ram was getting impatient every day. His main object of traveling in the north seemed to have been fulfilled after visiting Kashi. Now he wanted to return to South India, Ram's will. Nothing happens in this world but subject to his divine will. Ram's ways are always inscrutable. The next day, the train carried the Sadhu Ram and Ram Das to Ayodhya, the place where Sri Ramachandra lived and reigned. It was the night when the pilgrims reached the place. They rested for the night in an open passenger shed outside the station. The cold was intense. The Sadhu Ram suggested that both should lie down back to back, the backs touching each other. This device was adopted in order to exchange one another's heat for the body for mutual warmth. Really an original idea. Thus passed the night. Early next day, both proceeded to the city and then to the Saruya River. Washing the hands and feet, the Sadhu Ram suggested that no bath need be taken as the cold was very great. So returning from the holy river, they visited various mandirs of Ram Sharanda and Hanumanji, securing food at the Kestra, and that very night caught a train going down towards Bombay. So this is where Rama and Sita and Hanuman were, Ayodhya. Now the Sadhu Ram had once and for all decided to close the northern Indian pilgrimage and hence the journey toward Bombay. O Ram, thy will is supreme. Although Ram Das has yet to visit more shrines of the north, India, it is beyond thy humble slave to know the reason for thy taking him to Bombay. Every move thou givest to the situation of thy Das is considered by him to be the best. The train traveled, taking the Sadhu south and south. Station after station was passed. At a small station, while the Sadhu Ram was dozing, some passengers, who had not perhaps any pot with him, took away, while alighting, the brass pot of the Sadhu Ram, who woke up and discovered his loss after the train had left the station. He began to fret over the loss a great deal. In fact, he wept bitterly over it like a child. The next station was Jhansi, which was duly reached. Here the ticket inspector was very strict. So the ticket clerk pulled down these sadhus, as well as many others from the carriages, and led them all near the gate, leading them out of the station. There were in all about 10 sadhus. The ticket clerk made all of them stand in a line on one side of the entrance or exit. It was both. The passengers were now going out of the station, and the clerk was collecting tickets at the gate. His back turned against the sadhus, who were made to stand only at arm's length from the clerk. The first in the line of the sadhus was a young sannyasi with a jadat, or tuft of matted hair. Whenever the ticket clerk had a momentary respite from the collection of tickets, he would turn round and, clutching the tuft of hair of the young sadhu who was nearest him, shake his head violently. The next moment he had to attend to the ticket collection. When the stream of passengers thinned and there was some break, he would again handle the head of the sadhu and give it a shake or inflict blows upon it with his fist. While this was going on, by a look at the face of the sadhu who was next to him in line, Ram Das made out that there was a happy smile on the face of the young sadhu. I'm going to keep going because this is chapter 19. Love conquers hate. The sadhu seemed to enjoy the treatment. He was calm and contented. Ram Das, wishing also to taste the pleasure, requested the sadhu to exchange places with him and thus offer him also the unique opportunity of receiving the attention of the ticket clerk. But the sadhu would not be persuaded to abandon his enviable position. Off and on, the clerk was meting out this treatment to the willing sadhu. This continued for nearly half an hour. The ticket collection work at last stopped. Now the clerk was totally free from work, and he turned right toward the sadhus. He approached the other sadhus, of whom Ram Dass was the second, with the object of handling them roughly one by one. Ram Dass felt much relief to see that his turn had at last come. The clerk, coming up, caught his hand in a firm grasp and looked on his face, in which he discovered a most welcoming smile, bright and beaming. At once he let go of his hand, and drawing himself back a few steps, seemed to have given himself to some thinking. It was Ram who was at work. For the next instant, he asked all the sadhus to go out of the station. Accordingly, all the sadhus left the station and went out one by one. O Ram, when thy invincible arm protects thy slave, where was there fear for him? One thing was proved incontestable and beyond any doubt, and that was thou disarmest the evil intentions of an adversary when he approaches you in a violent mood by meeting him with a smile instead of that with fear or hatred. Love can surely conquer hate. Love is a sovereign antidote for all the ills of the world. After all, the whole occurrence might be only Ram testing the sadhus to see if they would lose their self-control under provocation. All that Ram does is for the best. Now the time was about 2 o'clock past midnight. It was pitch dark, so the sadhus sought for a place on the station for taking rest for the night. But conditions for doing this were far from favorable. The station was full to overflowing, as it were, with passengers. Every available nook and corner of the portion of the station intended for the passengers was occupied, and they were all scattered on the floor, sleeping in fantastic postures, all space filled up. However, Ram Dass and his guide, the Sadhuram, crept near a pillar where there was to be found room for both to sit on their legs. The cold here also was very severe. The sadhu sat up close to and pressed against each other, so much so that they seemed almost molded into one piece. Ram Bhajan was going on. Ram Dass became unconscious and dozed away where he sat and did not wake up until he was roused by a strong and shrill voice asking all passengers to take their feet and walk out of the station. This was the order of the railway police. Ram Dass opened his eyes and instantly became conscious of his body, which was discovered to be in a peculiar condition. The legs had turned so stiff with cold that they had stuck fast at the bend of the knee joint, and on a look at them he further made out that from the knee downward both the legs had swollen, and also the feet, as though they were stricken with elephantitis. However, by rubbing them briskly by both hands for about 5 minutes, he could unlock the stiffened joints. Slowly rising up, he hobbled along for some distance. As he walked on, the stiffness disappeared. About 8 a.m., they reached the city of Yansi, about 4 miles from the station. The last Ram Nam that Kate just led was the first one that I ever heard. And I remember David singing it. We were in his green truck, just the two of us driving somewhere, and he started to sing it. And as he says, when he first heard it with Mother, he wasn't sure if he liked it or not. And I kind of had that same sense of, well, it's so repetitious, and I'm not sure if I enjoy that or not. But it stuck in my head, and I never forgot that tune of Ram Nam, and that's the one that I usually go back to. I was thinking tonight, getting ready for the evening and knowing that this book, In Quest of God, is what really, meeting David is what brought me onto the path, but In Quest of God was what helped me to understand my particular path. And with David as my guru and master and mother's teachings and David's teachings, I came to this path and to know that I could do it, but there was something magical about In Quest of God, of Papa saying that if you simply remember God, you will have him. And him going through all these experiences and showing that remembering God in every experience is what led him to his realization. And I was making notes of why that was so important to me and kind of going back through my life. And I was raised Catholic, and at the age of 10, I went to my mom and said that I wanted to be a nun. And she was kind of excited about it and also really disappointed in that she imagined having grandchildren and me being a mother. But she took it seriously and took me to the priest, and she and the priest talked to me about why I would want to be a nun. And I said, well, I know that I can never not sin, and I don't want to go to hell. And I think that if I was a nun, I might have a better chance of not going to hell, because I knew that I could not keep myself from sinning. And luckily, both my mother and the priest tried not to laugh, but understood that that was not a true calling from God by a 10-year-old, and turned me back to regular Sunday or Catholic catechism classes, and that I would be okay, that God would forgive me. But I still never let go of that I could never be good enough to not end up in some sort of hell. And that was my earliest memories, was of being afraid of going back to purgatory, is what I realized it was, this in-between state that I had been in at some point prior to this life, where I was awake in a twilight state, but not able to engage in the astral. So it was this long, what felt like eternity, dark time that I was just in a twilight state. And then I went from Catholicism to humanism, and the idea that I could never help enough, I could never be good enough to kind of earn my way to being. And at that point, I wasn't sure about heaven, but that I didn't want to not give enough, not help enough. And then I explored meditation through Unity Church and the Unitarian Church, and I found that I could never focus well enough for meditation to kind of give me any kind of lasting relief. And then I found David. And as a devotee, I felt like I could never be obedient enough. So David would show me the way, and I would do it for a little while, and then I would kind of scoot along and get off what I was supposed to be doing. And of course, this is a long time ago, everyone. But I would fail in that way, too. And then Papa showed that all you really had to do was remember God at all times, and that you could do that by singing. And I thought, I think I can do that. I think I think I might be able to do that. You know, I don't have to be good enough. I don't have to be clever enough. I don't have to figure it out. But I can just keep bringing myself back to God. And I remember when that idea struck me after reading In Quest of God, that all I had to do was remember God all the time. And I would catch myself, and it would have been 2 or 3 weeks at that point, because this is very early in my path, 2 or 3 weeks, and I would have realized I hadn't really thought about God. Unless it was right in front of my face, you know, if I was talking to David about something or reading something. And then as I came onto the path more and spent more time with other spiritual people, it would be a week, maybe sometimes would go by, and life would catch me up, and spending time with other people and trying to advance in my career, all those things would catch me up, and I would go a week without thinking about God. And then it became a few days, and then it got to the point where if I didn't think about God and it had been an hour, I would catch myself and think, I can't believe that I forgot God for the last hour. And now it's, knock wood, a rare incident where God is not with me, where God is, that thought of God, what is God thinking? What is God doing? How are we interacting? What would you have me do? Is a rare to have that thought away from me. It can be very much in the front, or it can some of the times be a quiet little whisper in the back. But to go an hour or two without God, without the consciousness of God's presence, becomes very rare in our lives as we go along with this. And when we notice that it's fallen from our memories, simply singing God's name brings him immediately back. He can't resist the sound of his name being sung by his devotees. And our hearts become full and our minds become clear. I was listening to a talk of David's today, and he was talking about rubbing a few people the wrong way, because he said, he was giving a talk at the ashram in India, and said, if it's become rote, your Ram Nam, you're not really thinking of God. And it's not really useful. And so to bring that depth and love back into Ram Nam, to call God near through our devotion that way. And that's all it takes. It doesn't have to be difficult. It doesn't have to be something that we search for, that we have to find, that we have to do correctly. It's simply keeping our minds on God and allowing God's light and love, his essence, to flow through us, and to be aware that it's flowing through us, because it always is, or we wouldn't exist. And so that's what In Quest of God did for me, is it gave me the easy route. I just thought to share that tonight. We're over the halfway mark in Quest of God. I also want to share a little bit more of Swamiji's points on this. Possess things, but do not be possessed by them. Here also it was a test. He himself says it was a test to see whether he joins the Sadhuram in grumbling. Whatever said and done, I have very few belongings, but even for the few belongings, I may have 100% possessive feelings. For all practical purposes, suppose we have 100 things in our room. While you have only 2 things in your room, quantum-wise, you are leading a simple life, But if one of those two, one is lost, what happens to you matters. So gently, Papa is warning us, don't think that just because you have reduced your possessions, you are free from possessiveness. In order to make us aware of this, God made the Sadhu Ram lose his brass pot, and he grumbled. However, Papa smilingly said, it is Ram's will. So the learning is this. It is not the quantity that matters, but it is the possessiveness of whatever we have that matters. Later on, we will realize that if we are freed from possessiveness, any number of articles may be there, but we will not identify with them. We will not own them. It will come and go. That is all. A very important point for all of us to think about. David loved Master's story of that he would go into any house or ride in any car, and the time that he spent there, he would imagine that all the things there were his. And then when he walked out, they would all belong back to the ether or to whoever they belonged to. And Greg and I this weekend were down in Seattle, and we found the first house that David and Carla rented. They had been living with Kate and Larry and what people now call couch surfing, and finally found a little tiny rental house that they could afford. And I had had this idealized image of what that little house looked like, because I haven't been there for probably 16 or 17 years since they moved out. And it was so rough and so modest, beyond modest on the outside. I know they made it really charming on the inside, but it was literally in the parking lot of an apartment complex and had a giant dumpster out in front of it. And for them to go from that to the big, beautiful house that they lived in at the end of David's life. And David was equally comfortable whether they were living out of their car or he was living out of his truck with just places to stay that people granted him, or in the big, beautiful two-story mansion overlooking the water. He was equally comfortable in either, and equally detached, saying that if God took it all away, it would only be for the better. And so to live our lives in that way, that anything that comes to us, we check in, is this for the highest good? Is it serving its highest purpose being with me? Or is it time to let it go? And if something disappears from our grasp, to know that it's for the best, that we no longer have it, to see it all as God's will, his divine intervention. And the second part is about the cruel ticket taker. When dealing with bullies, rather than reproaching them based on righteousness, we should handle them with love. This will transform their attitude, and they may not harass anyone in the future. I think this is a really, I'm going to read you the rest of what Swamiji wrote, and I think it's so profound. Another point is when someone is persecuted, harassed, teased, there are two ways of dealing with it. One is to oppose it under the banner of righteousness. That will not transform the other person's mind. If I start arguing based upon righteousness, it is not going to transform the other person who is teasing, who is harassing, who is doing just for the sake of harming others, as he finds pleasure in it, sadism. But here, Papa brings out a beautiful theory theme, that your actions should be such that it transforms the other person. And it did transform the ticket taker. You remember the ticket examiner was shaking the hair of the sadhu, and the sadhu cheerfully allowed it with patience instead of resistance. It may be a tall order. We may not suggest this to everybody, but those who have got this mental makeup, those who go along with this, they will be able to understand it better. Otherwise, the mind will come and say, under the banner of righteousness, this is wrong. This is exploitation. This is this. This is that. You are right, but transformation is the only option. Tomorrow you may resist, but you have not removed the tendency from the bully's mind, and others will definitely have to suffer it. Suppose you remove that tendency once and for all from him. He will not have it. This is what had happened. When the sadhu cheerfully submitted to the ticket taker's actions, Papa was waiting. Papa asked, "Can I take your place?" The sadhu said no. He was enjoying it. Had he started complaining, grumbling, showing resistance through his body language, what would have been its effect on others? Just imagine. How would we know about endurance? How would we know about patience? How will we know about meekness? The first sadhu teaches a lot of lessons. It's a very, very difficult attitude to take. And as Swamiji says, it's not an attitude that everyone can take or everyone should take. But to consider it the next time that you're approached wrongly or with animosity, when someone wants to fight, to see it as an opportunity to just beam God on them, not resist. There's a saying, resist not the devil and he will flee. So look for an opportunity where you can emulate Papa and the sadhu in that way. I'm not saying go out and have someone beat you up, but you'll know when there's a time that you can show that patience and perseverance. And then lastly, love conquers hate. Then when Papa's turn came, when his whole body language is only showering love on the ticket taker, that instance, his attitude changed once and for all. So if we go through the episode of In Quest of God again and again, what we find is that it is not only for our spiritual progress, but also for a harmonious social life, family life, and professional life. So with that, Bhagavan, we pray to him from the bottom of the hearts again. You are facilitating so many practical clues for making our life blissful, connecting us to him. By ourselves, we cannot do it, but to make use of what you have provided, we need your grace. Please make me aware of it. And to recap, possess things, but do not be possessed by them. When dealing with bullies, rather than reproach them, based on righteousness, we should handle them with love. This will transform their attitude, and they may not harass anyone in the future. Love conquers hate. And I think we'll close with a prayer that used to be said at the ashram at eventide. This day is almost gone. When night and morning meet, it will only be an unalterable memory. So let no unkind word and careless doubting thought, no guilty secret, no neglected duty, no wisp of jealous fog ever becloud its passing. Now In token of our deep and abiding love, we would lay aside all disturbing thoughts, all misunderstandings, all unworthiness. If things have gone wrong, let none of us lift an accusing finger. Who is to blame is not important. Only how shall we set the situation right? And so, serving and being served, loving and being loved, we shall make this a peaceful haven where we, the children of God, shall live harmoniously, joyfully singing his name and glories till we merge our little selves in his eternal being and existence. Only in duality can love work. God can give back to God. Anybody have any comments or questions? Next week we'll have another session, and then the week after, Larry or Peter will, whoever's interested, will give a talk on something else for our break time.
Bill, I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead, Jerry.
What do you mean only in duality love works?
Because if there's only one, there's no lover and no loved.
Mm-hmm.
Only when we have an object can love exist.
Hmm.
But if there's only the unity of God's love,
there's only God.
To be only God, but he's defined as love.
Mm. But when there's only one, there's no definition.
Yeah, I'm going to have to ponder on that.
If it's called unity, I don't know. Is that a definition? I'm not meaning to mince words.
Well, what if there's only one, what can be unified?
Anyways, I don't want to get into it. But they always say God is love. Perhaps only if there is a beloved.
Yeah. God is,
but I, yeah.
God created so that he could express love. Otherwise, he just is love.
That's a philosophical question, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. Thank you, Jill.
Mm. Split himself into separate beings so that he could express what could only be expressed when there's another. It's a beautiful thought, really. Imagine feeling so much love, being complete love, and wanting to share it. God had the idea of sharing love, and all creation came into being. And so we loving and being loved, serving and being served. It requires two. Requires an other. We'll go out with Prem singing to us.